Don't mess up now.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hi there, everyone. This is Fran Lewis, and guess what? The sun is finally shining. It's not raining outside, and this is going to be tons of fun. We have the author of The Homeport Journals. Let me tell you a little bit about it. Fleeing New York City and an abusive partner would be writer Mark Nugent's finds at work at Homeport, the Providence mansion of Lola Stanton, a fabulous wealthy recluse. Now, Lola and her sister have been estranged for many years, 60 years. So the past and present converge when a long-lost journal reveals tales of infidelity, cool, right? Adultery, passion, and the mirror of life Mark has recently abandoned. Well, to learn more about what happened, we have the author, A.C. Birch, and this book is a serious must-read. Hi, how you doing?
I'm doing very well, Fran. Very happy to be with you.
Me too. Oh, my goodness. You know, if it's not bad enough that my doctor and my dentist just checked in, my ear, nose, and throat doctor just checked in, too, on the Internet. They just emailed me. They're going to have to wait. So when you created this novel, how did you create Mark? And when and how did you decide to place him in your own hometown? And what makes Provincetown special?
Oh, those are great questions. I think, you know, I've lived in Provincetown for almost 30 years, and I've seen a lot of people come here to kind of get away from the life that they had. You know, they didn't like their prior life, and they thought by coming to Provincetown that somehow they'd either get a fresh start or things would be different. And sometimes it works. Sometimes, you know, people stay here for the rest of their lives. Some only stay like a season, and then they go somewhere else and do the same thing all over again. You know, So I witnessed this idea of getting away to Provincetown, and I saw it over and over again. So that made me think that there was something there for the character. I started writing kind of late in life. I trained as a classical musician, and I was grappling a bit when I first started to write the book about the differences between performance and creative writing. And so I kind of worked that into the story. Mark, you know, is someone who really wants to write. He can't write in the life that he's in. He has a lot of abuse that's happening to him. So he does what a lot of people do and run away to Provincetown. And Provincetown, you know, is a good place to run away to. It's absolutely beautiful. I'm looking out my window right now, and the harbor is sparkling. I can see the lighthouse and the boats going back and forth. And it's an incredibly unusual town. We're way out in the Atlantic Ocean. We're out at the tip of Cape Cod, there's only one way into town by land. Everything else is surrounded by water. There's actually 21 miles of coastline around Provincetown, and you're very aware of the ocean, the elements. It's never the same. The light changes. A lot of artists have come here over the years, you know, to paint because the light is so beautiful here. And it's just a very engaging and wonderful place to be. Also, Provincetown had a reputation for being different almost from the time the first people set foot here. For a long time, it was just sort of open land and fishermen that would, you know, put huts on the beach and fish and whatnot. It was called the Province Lands. And eventually it became a town. And one of the early things that happened was that the town of Truro said, this place is outrageous. There's too many crazy things going on, and they became their own town. They broke off, and I think, you know, it's always been a concentration of unusual people, creative people. A lot of artists came up from New York, you know, in the 1890s, 1900, and you know, folks like Hans Hoffmann, Franz Kline, Robert Motherwell in later years. A lot of creative people enjoying the beauty of the place, and for a long time it was a very inexpensive place to live. And it's got this kind of close-knit, we're all in it together kind of feeling to it. When you're here in the winter, there are very, very few people. And we also to look out for each other and take care of each other. So that all rolled together to make, you know, the town a place that Mark would have seen and want to go to. And a place where he might be able to become a writer.
It's too bad they didn't put the pictures in the book.
I thought about that. What I do is I post
really
a lot of pictures
for
up on
yeah.
my
make a whole bunch of
on
people.
My website. That people can go and see what I'm talking about if they go to the website acbirch.com.
Well, we're going to remind everybody about that at the end, too. So Mark is leaving, and he meets Dory. And why did the chance meeting start a chain of events that would change his life and hers? And tell us about Dory. I love Dory.
Thank you. A lot of people do. In fact, I just got a new pup, and I named her Dory because I'm very fond of Dory, my pup. So Mark had suffered a lot of abuse in this relationship, and maybe we can talk about that a little later. But let me give you set the scene for you. He leaves New York. He's got nothing but the clothes on his back, his computer, and his car. And he runs out in the middle of the night, and he drives all through the night. And he parks out at Herring Cove Beach, which is this beautiful beach, just a little bit beyond the center of town. And so he's got to eat. So, you know, he sleeps in the car and he comes into town. And it's November. There's not a lot of places that are open. It's after the tourist season. And he goes to the Purple Feather, which is this wonderful pastry shop on Commercial Street, which is sort of the main drag. There's only two main streets in Provincetown. One is Commercial Street and the other is Bradford Street. So he's having his hot cup of hot chocolate, and he looks out the window, and he sees this tiny old lady, and she's got these huge bags of groceries. And she's coming down the street, and all of a sudden, a storm is coming in, and it starts to rain. And, of course, they're paper bags, so they got all wet, and they just broke. And all of her groceries rolled down the steps of the Purple Feather and into the street. And Mark's a decent sort of guy. He grew up in Canada, and he's very genuine and sincere. And so he goes to help. He tries to get to rescue the groceries, because of course there's cars coming down the street and they could get flattened and everything. So he runs out into this rainstorm and he tries to help Dory. Well, what does Dory do? She goes into the Purple Feather and she starts drinking his hot chocolate. And so she sits there watching him, and he's running around trying to pick up the groceries, and he's getting soaking wet, and she's just sitting there watching him and drinking his hot chocolate. So when he gets done, he comes back in, and Dory is in her mid-80s. She's tiny. She's absolutely tiny, kind of hunched over, and she's been out in the wind and the elements all her life, so she's very wrinkled, and she's kind of like a gnarled bush or something. She's just all wrinkles and hunched over. But they kind of connect. She's very, very intuitive. She just reads him very quickly and understands that he's a decent sort and that he is really well intentioned. But unusual in some ways for a person that young, Mark also understands her in a way. He realizes that she's a special person. So they connect. And what ends up happening is he buys her a hot chocolate and a piece of cake, and she starts asking him about, you know, when did he get here, and she gets the story out of him very quickly that he's just gotten here and he has no place to live and he has no work, which is difficult. In November, there's very few jobs to be had. If you haven't gotten your job for the winter lined up and you don't have unemployment, you're in tough shape. So she actually takes him back to try to get him a job. So they connect immediately in this thing that I love of the very, very old woman and the young, earnest, well-intentioned young man. And so off they go to Homeport.
Well, she has, who is Lola? And why did she take Mark into her home? And why did she remain in her home? And why did she remain in her home? And she very rarely went out.
That's right. That's right. She's she's the last of a long line of Yankee New Englander whaling and fishing families. It's not widely known, but Provincetown was once one of the wealthiest towns in the state of Massachusetts. And there was a big shipping and whaling industry here that eventually was overtaken by New Bedford and, you know, things like that. But there was a lot of money made here in the 1800s. And there were large mansions that lined Commercial Street. And there used to be over 60 wharves that went out into the harbor and had all of these boats tied up to them and everything. And in Homeport journals, Lola is the last one of that family left. And she is out at the very far end of town on the original family estate with a big house and a lot of land for Provincetown, a tremendous amount of land. And she really never leaves the place. She had a very difficult childhood. Her mother and father were constantly fighting with her. There were a whole host of horrible things that happened that she witnessed, and she sort of became afraid of life. And because she's got this vast fortune, and she's walled herself up in this house for more than 80 years, she keeps everything the way it always was. So, you know, they used to have tea in the parlor, so they still have tea in the parlor. The house was always immaculately painted and beautifully cleaned, and she sees to it that it still is. And what happens is she basically recruits people to come and care for her as if they were servants. They're not really, because she doesn't have a lot for them to do, but she hires someone to drive her. Though she never goes anywhere, she hires someone to work in the garden, but she doesn't have a garden. But she brings these people into the estate so that she can live and have company, and she doesn't have to go out into the world, which she's really afraid of. She had the money. She has the money to do this, so she just creates kind of this world on the other side of the gate that is the way things were in the 1860s.
Well, I like tea time and tea and China
coffee. I do too.
And I don't drink coffee. I drink decaf tea, so to me, she would be just fine for me. And as far as hiring a chauffeur or somebody to drive me, I don't drive, so that would be great, too.
There you go.
So that would be me. And after what's been happening to me, I sometimes feel like I want to hide under a rock. So what happened between her and Dory that they haven't spoken for 60 years? That's horrible.
Well, this is kind of at the core of the story, but let me describe a little bit of it without giving too much away. So
When
you go up the drive to the Homeport Mansion, which sits way, way up on a it's really a sand dune that's been, you know, turned into lawns and stuff like that, and it looks out all over Cape Cod Bay and the Atlantic. There's another house very close to it on the way up the driveway, and that's where Dory lives. But she and Lola had grown up as friends. There's a 10-year difference in their ages, but it was so isolated out there when they were children that they really kind of grew up as sisters. They played together all the time. They were very, very, very close. But later on, when Dory was in her early 20s, she started to hear rumors, because she would go into town and she would see other people, even if Lola didn't. She started to hear rumors that Lola's father had killed Dory's mother. And she came and she confronted Lola about it, and Lola was so upset that rather than admitting that she also had suspicions, because she'd seen some things as a young girl that made her think this might have happened, rather than admitting that, she just banished Dory from the house. She wouldn't talk to her anymore. She wouldn't let her in. She wouldn't communicate with her in any way. So we have a situation where the two friends are living probably 500 feet from each other, and they haven't talked in over 60 years. I mean, if they've had to do something, they've talked, but they've never been friends. You know, there's just been this barrier. Because Lola, she really feels she's the last one to uphold the family reputation, and she just won't have any more scandals. She doesn't want to think about it. She just crowds Dory out and won't deal with her. Dory, on the other hand, keeps watching her and keeps trying to rekindle the friendship and feels very strongly that she needs to take care of her. So when Dory brings Mark back, she brings him into the estate, and she arranges for him to go over and try to see if he can get the gardener's job that Lola's just lost her gardener, and even though winter is coming, she wants to have people around. So Mark goes over and interviews for that job.
Well, he does, and that sort of starts a whole chain reaction. It's great. But for those people out there that are listening, you know, I lost my sister 5 years ago, and she was my very best friend, and I don't think I ever had a fight with her ever. And if we had, you know, disagreement, we straightened it out. So people, before it's too late, you don't want to do that.
Exactly.
You seriously don't want to do
one
that.
One of the themes of the book, you know, is the time that's lost. You know, when you have these altercations. Exactly.
Yeah. Well, my favorite character, I don't know if you're going to believe me, this, my favorite character is Helena.
Ah.
I love Helena. And when I finally realized, I said, this is really cool. So tell us more about her. She's smart, she's savvy, and she sort of runs the show in Lola's house. And nobody messes with her. So tell everybody about her. She's cool. I loved her.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that. Yeah, she's wonderful. And basically, she really fascinates me. Helena came from, it fascinates me. And I'd like to digress for just a second and share just a little bit of her background. I actually did a blog on my website about this, but I think it will help you understand the kind of character that she is. If I just add this, I went to high school and graduated and went on to music school, and my sister was 4 years behind me and 4 years younger. So I went back to my old high school to see a play that she was in. And there had been this fellow that had been really brutalized for being gay. People found out that he was gay, and they gave him a really, really tough time. And I had not thought of him for a number of years. But when I came back, it's the high school thing. They always have the reception. They have the punch and cookies and everything. So we're all in the cafeteria, and I look over, and here's this. I really don't know how to describe it. He was no longer a fellow. He had decided he was transgender, or realized he was transgender, and came back in this long black wig and a pantsuit and red roses, and he stood there, and he really confronted everybody that he didn't say a word. He just looked at them, everybody that had the teachers that hadn't helped him and some of the people that had given him a tough time. And years later, this character sort of emerged in Helena. She's a cross-dresser. She seldom, if ever, dresses in men's clothing. And she's what I call a shapeshifter. She can be whatever you want. And she has her own little insecurities and whatnot in some ways. But when she's in a particular outfit, she's incredibly powerful and she's incredibly strong. And so she really is this amazing person who takes care of everyone. She's the housekeeper for Lola's estate, for the Homeport Mansion. And a lot of times she roams around this big place and she's dressed like Mrs. Danvers from Rebecca, a very severe, Victorian housekeeper. Mm-hmm. But in other times she dresses in other ways. And she kind of takes everybody under her wing and she cares for them. The only fear she really has is she doesn't really want to show you how she really looks. So she's always dressed as somebody else. And this was really useful for me because there's a scene in the book where I really needed someone to be able to go out and not be recognized. And so Helena is sort of the perfect change artist. But she's funny and she's really, really protective and loyal. And it's almost like she gives so much of herself that the people at Homeport, they start giving back because she's made them feel as though they can maybe be just a little kinder and just a little more gentle. And so Helena is really the one that creates the environment. And, of course, Mark, shows up and he walks right into the middle of this situation and she has a crush on him. So he sort of has to work his way through that. But they become very good friends. And Helena is, whenever I talk with readers, everybody loves Helena. And she's funny because she gave herself her own name, but her last name is Handbasket, so she calls herself Hell in a Handbasket.
Sounds like what some people call me. What can I tell you? Yeah, I am definitely what you call Hell in a Handbasket. That's what they claim. But
you
know what? That's
yours.
Good. That's it. So now we've got Mark, the love interest for Cole.
Yeah. Cole is an artist. Yeah. I want to take a minute and say something here. The book is not a place where everybody that has psychological problems all comes together and hides out. What we have are some very talented and strong and capable people, but like all of us, they have their challenges and they have their issues. And Cole is, his thing is that he basically is an extremely talented artist, but he doesn't have any faith in himself at all. And he went and took courses, and he got through school. But no matter what he does, he just doesn't believe in himself. And had a show. There are almost 60 galleries in Provincetown, so there are a lot of art shows, and some of them are very, very well attended. And he had a show, but there were these two con artists, and they were trying to knock down the price of his work so that they could make more money on it by reselling it. And he misunderstood them, and he closed down the show, and he burnt all of his paintings. Lola managed to rescue two, but other than that, he burnt all his paintings. And so Lola knew about this, and she brought him to Homeport. And so he's been acting as the handyman for the house, and he's been doing minor chores and stuff like that. But he's been just as walled away as Lola is until Mark comes.
And tell us a little bit about Mark's background and why he escaped and who Brandon is.
Yeah, Mark, as I said, grew up in Canada, and he went to school for a while. He's an orphan by the time the story occurs. And he ended up in New York, and he was doing the kind of, you know, take writing classes and wait on tables at night kind of thing that happens a lot. And he met this fellow who came from a fairly well-to-do family and certainly had enough money for them to live comfortably. And they start a romantic relationship. But the fellow is he's kind of a party guy, and he gets in a little too deep, and he gets addicted to crystal meth. And crystal meth can be very dangerous to certain types of personalities if they get too addicted to it and everything. It can, you know, you can get schizophrenic. It brings out aggressiveness and delusions and paranoia. And this is what Mark, you know, this is his first loving relationship, and all of a sudden his partner starts to turn into someone else. It's kind of like a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde thing.
Mm-hmm.
And Mark stands by, and he does all that he possibly can. But finally, he reaches that point, which most people do if they're dealing with someone with a dependency, where they realize, you know, I can't do any more than this. And Brandon, the partner, has become very violent. So Mark is now afraid. He's afraid for his life. And that's why he runs away to Provincetown.
Wow. So let's get to the title of the book, which deals with journals. So what are the journals? What are is the significance of the journals? What other journals does he find? And how does it change the relationship possibly between Lola and Dory? And what does he learn from reading about them, about her past and her mother and all the rest?
Well, you know, I've always been intrigued with the notion that you know, people can put down their thoughts on a piece of paper and that lasts a lot longer than they do. And so what I tried to set up in the book was a parallel situation where Mark is a writer, and he keeps a journal. It's ostensibly ideas and snippets of things that he might want to write about, but he's also using it to document what happened with Brandon and to be sure that if something happens to Mark, people know that his life was being threatened. So he keeps this journal. And then what I did in the book was have another journal be found. So Lola's father, who was a sea captain, and he spent much of his life sailing around the world on whaling ships, he wrote a journal, a series of journals as well, and one of them has been missing for more than 50 years. And Mark and Cole find that. So we have a situation. We have the story that's taking place now, which is Mark's story, and that's in his journal. And the book is written from parts of Mark's journal, but then we have everything that happened to the captain a long time ago, and that's in the journal that was found. And that, it goes right to the heart of the relationship between Lola and Dory, where Lola thought she saw her father with Dory's mother's body. In other words, she thought that he had killed her. He was actually trying to save her. And Dory never knew much about it, but the rumors were out there in the town, but the journal has the true story in it. So when the journal is found, then that starts the process that allows the two friends, who are almost sisters, to reconcile and to understand each other.
So who is Annie, and why did her mother, Prudence, hate her?
Well, Annie
was
a servant in the Homeport mansion, and actually Captain Staunton fell in love with her. And Prudence was Captain Staunton's wife, and she married him at a very young age because her family needed money. So imagine, you know, she came from a family, a wealthy family. They lost their money. And she marries this man, and she ends up out in Provincetown, which, you know, it's you know, hundreds of miles away from anywhere where there's a lot of society or anything like that. It's a fishing village. And she's living out there now. He's out at sea. She's all by herself. And so she actually gets carried away. Prudence ends up being kind of a naughty girl. She gets involved with some local artists. She starts to have some affairs. She just gets kind of swept up in things. And before you know it, she's chasing her boyfriends back to New York, and there's all of this sort of stuff happening. And the captain eventually comes home from the sea, and he comes home to an absolute mess. His wife is running around like crazy. The house is in an uproar. Everybody's angry with everybody else, and he spends time in the kitchen having dinner with the cook because basically she's the only one that seems to be sane. And eventually they fall in love. And that's Annie. Annie is the cook. She's a local Portuguese girl from the town, a very sweet, simple, you know, sincere woman. Everything Captain Staunton's wife is not. And so she basically, you know, they fall in love, and he's going to try to get a divorce. And the need for the divorce becomes even stronger because Annie gets pregnant. So he's trying to divorce Prudence, and he's trying to get his own life. And Prudence agrees. She's like, you know, give me a lot of money and I'll go away. I don't want to be here anyways. I'll go and then live the high life with my younger boyfriend in New York. And everything's going along really well. The baby's about due, and then the boyfriend dumps Prudence. So all of a sudden she's got no one, and she changes her mind. She says, you know, you have to give me everything. I'm not going to just walk away from this. You know, I'm somebody. I've got this, I've got that. You have to give it all up. And she's really angry of the captain's love for Annie. So that messes everything up. And Prudence gets involved, and she confronts Annie right after the baby is born. And she upsets Annie by telling her the captain has abandoned her. And so Annie attempts to commit suicide. The captain is actually right there in the house, and he's the one that rescues Annie. But to everybody that saw it, when he's carrying her back, she tries to drown herself. When he's carrying her back from the beach, it looks as though he's trying to get rid of her body. And that's where the rumors came from.
That's scary. Just the slightest look, the slightest anything can change everybody's lives at that stage.
In a small town, it's like, you know, it's in a small town. You know, somebody sees one thing, and everybody knows within 24 hours. And if that person was wrong about what they saw, you know, it almost doesn't matter because the story that's out there is what everybody's going to believe.
I know. It's like an investigation, and people see it in different ways. There were witnesses that see things differently. Nobody sees it the same way.
Exactly.
And usually they just exactly say, well, that's what happened, and the birth is whatever. And Prudence was wicked. Boy, she really kept the captain captive for too long. So
she did.
Yeah, she did. I didn't like her at all. And when did not bother me. So why was Mark so determined to help Cole? And what did Cole do that set them apart? And why does Mark come off as being kind of aloof and unfeeling at one point?
Well, you know, it's interesting. My experience with people who are grappling with fairly significant challenges is they don't see themselves all that well. They don't. You know, but you know what's interesting to me is they're usually the ones that are really ready to tell someone else what they should be doing. They should be doing their own work, but they're pretty involved, and they'll say, well, you need to do this and you need to do that. So basically, from Mark's perspective, when he sees the two paintings that Lola has rescued, you know, Cole burnt all his work, except Lola managed to get two of them, and she has them, and she has them hidden in the house in a place where Cole can't find them. And she shows them to Mark, and he is astounded at how beautiful they are and how powerful they are and how well done they are. And he decides that it would be a real crime if Cole didn't share his talent with the world. Well, Cole has had some real trauma in his life, and he's like a wild animal. He doesn't believe he's a good artist. He's given up on that. He doesn't want to do it. He doesn't want to have anything to happen. So Mark sets about, and I don't want to give this away because it's one of my favorite parts of the story, but he sets about tricking Cole into getting back into painting, and Cole does. And so, you know, Cole, he's grateful in a way, and he really admires Mark, and much like Mark, he sees all these things in Mark that Mark doesn't see in himself. So we've got two guys, and they're kind of looking cross purposes at each other, and they each one thinks the other one is pretty special, but they don't have a lot of confidence themselves. But what Cole does eventually is he paints a portrait of Mark, and it's Mark writing up in the tower of Homeport. Homeport has this beautiful tower that looks out all, you can see everywhere from it, and he goes up there to write. And so Mark and Cole, they're becoming close. They take long walks together, and they talk about writing, and they talk about art, and they talk about all these things that inspire them. So when Mark goes and sees the painting, he gets terribly upset because Cole has painted him as Cole sees him, confident, capable. He's sitting there writing, you know, as if he was the best writer in the world. And there's so much confidence and pride in him. Mark goes absolutely crazy because that's how he doesn't see himself. And that's how he doesn't see himself that way. And unintentionally, he destroys the painting. And, of course, that blows everything up between the two of them. And Mark comes across as incredibly unfeeling to Cole because he hasn't explained why, really. He just had this horrible reaction. He pushed the canvas. It fell over on top of something. It was torn apart. So that's that, and they disappear, and they really don't speak to each other for quite some time. And this is hard for Cole because Cole, you know, was just saying, this is what I see when I look at you. I see this. So you can imagine.
A lot of people don't see themselves the way other people see them.
Exactly. But to an artist, you know, the art, you can say that, and you can say words, and words, you know, are subject to interpretation. If you paint a portrait of someone, you're really putting it out there and saying, this is what I see in you. And it's tangible. It's right there, and it's kind of hard to argue with it.
Except when the other person doesn't see themselves the way the other person sees them.
Exactly.
Then it gets kind of hard.
And,
well, I can't draw. I can write, though, they tell me.
Absolutely.
And I want that wherever he was writing, that I'd love that tower to write in. That would be so nice rather than sitting at a cramped computer.
The original house is in the center of Provincetown. There's a gallery called the Gallery there, but I moved it way to the outside of town, and the tower is still there. I've been up in it, and it's the views are amazing from up there.
That sounds so nice. So what happens when Mark's boyfriend comes back into the picture?
Well,
he's completely out of his mind.
Yeah, he's got problems. There's no question about it. And he's become obsessed. He's got a single fixation. He is going to find Mark, and he is going to hurt him. And that's all Brandon is about. So basically, they found the journal, and this in a way brings Mark and Cole a bit together. But Brandon goes up and down every street in Provincetown, which is not a major thing to do. You know, the town itself is only a couple of square miles. But he finds out that Mark is actually in Provincetown from some sleazy friends that see him. And he goes and he tracks down Mark's car. And he actually goes onto the grounds of the estate and he finds the car. And he comes to the house and he threatens to harm Mark. But Helena steps in. And she doesn't let him get anywhere near Mark. But now Mark knows he's there, and the whole family, because by this time they've sort of become a family. These disparate people have come together. So everybody sort of takes up to protect Mark and make sure that Brandon doesn't do him any harm.
Well, I've got a question now based on that. Who is Charlotte? And how come she handled Lola's finances? And what, if anything, does she try to cement the relationships among those people living there?
Well, you know, Lola,
has
this amazing amount of money. But the reason she has the money is that Charlotte's family, for three generations, have been the financial advisors. They've taken care of the fortune. And one of the things about Lola is she's very lucky because people protect her. Helena takes care of her house. And protects her and keeps her rituals. And these other people, you know, they come and they talk with her and they help her create her own world. But behind all of that, for three generations, this family has made sure that the fortune stays intact. And Charlotte is she's this wonderful, smart, savvy New Yorker. And she's very fond of Lola. She considers her family as well. And she's one of these people that knows everybody and has her finger on the pulse and knows how to figure out things. And so in addition to making sure that Lola's financially secure, when Mark and Cole need to find out things about what happened, you know, to the captain and where money went at a certain time or all of these things, Charlotte has all of the records and all of the every single expenditure for the estate. For more than 100 years, Charlotte has access to that. It's all been put on microfiche, and she's able to go back and look at it. And so she kind of solves a lot of the, provides a lot of the opportunities to understand what happened way back in the time of the captain. And she's also, you know, a person who will really, she doesn't make any value judgments. She's very, very friendly with Helena. They share makeup tips and hints and stuff like that. She readily accepts Mark. She's just a really genuine, good person, but she's not from the home port world. She comes and visits every once in a while, but she's the one person out in the city that's really living her life and moving forward. And so she's their, really their link to the outside world.
Well, before I forget, and they don't have the link to the next week world, I'm going to be on the air, believe it or not, people, on Monday with New York Times bestselling author Simon Chavez, Thin Black Line, What Would You Do and How Would You React If Your Whole Family Was Killed in a Second? September 24th, Kenneth Wayne, and October 8th, Stephen Schurze, Enemy in the Heartland, and October 15th, New York Times bestselling author John Land, Strong Light of Day. You definitely want to read all of their novels and all of their books. And, of course, you want to read Home Port Journals because I'd be remiss if I told you that you didn't. I also finished this week, I don't know how, but I did, Everyone Has Their Reasons by Joseph Matthews. It's a great story about a young man that walks into a police station and kills somebody because of the fact that his family was taken away and killed in the Holocaust. That's just one of a whole bunch of books that Fran has read this week. So, what happens when both Dory and Lola finally meet? How do people that haven't spoken in 60 years, how do they react to each other?
Well, you know, it's the journals. The missing journal has something in it about Dory, it has something in it about Lola, and Cole and Charlotte, Helena and Mark, they go through and read certain parts of it, and then they decide to bring everybody together. So they actually smuggle Dory into one of Lola's teas in her very formal parlor. And it's really Helena who essentially says to Lola, trust this, listen for a minute. And they're really, really worried because Lola has a bad heart, and they don't want her to be upset, and they've spent a lot of time trying to decide if, you know, what her father has to say will be upsetting to her. But basically what happens is that they come together, and in the journal, it's the captain reveals that he is Dory's father. And so suddenly these two women that grew up as sisters may actually be sisters. Now, remember, Prudence was out and about. So there's a little uncertainty whether Lola is actually, her father was actually Captain Staunton or not. So she's inherited the Staunton fortune, but she may not be a Staunton. And despite that, Dory jumps in and says, you're a sister to me. I don't want any of your money. You are my sister. And they reconcile. And so that's just an incredible moment. And, of course, these people have all been working so hard to bring this about. So it's a very joyous reunion.
Well, I am very happy to say that New York Times bestselling author Simon Chavez just texted me and said he will be there Monday at 10, people. This is good.
Hi. Excellent. That's
well,
a
you
great
never
lineup.
Know. With you never know because everybody, what can I say? How would you describe how the other characters reacted to at the end of the story, to the final thing?
Oh, yeah, because, of course, Lola and Dory are old, and you know, they can't live forever. And, you know, this was a very tough thing for me to write. I fell in love with Lola and Dory. And
I loved them,
you know,
too, and I cried when you did that.
Well, I cried when I wrote it, Fran.
It was
so
a box of tissues, people.
So, you know, a family has been created. Armistead Maupin, the author of Tales of the City, he has this wonderful term. He calls it a logical family as opposed to a biological family. Mm. And I never heard the term while I was writing Homeport Journals. I actually went to a reading he did, and he mentioned it, and the book had already been written. But that's a lot what this is about. So now the challenge later on in the story is that these two women were the focus for the friends. They took care of them. They brought them together, and they successfully, you know, got them speaking to each other, and then over time, it doesn't happen immediately, over time they're gone. And so, you know, there's a big question here in a way, what do we do? Where do we focus now? And of course, the short answer is you focus on each other, but Lola and Dory were smart enough to give these people a task. They gave them a challenge. You know, it's the end of an era for Homeport. You know, Lola died, Dory inherited it, Dory dies, and now there's this place. It's an anachronism. It's too big to handle. There's just, you know, what's going to happen with it? And so that's the challenge that Lola and Dory leave in their wills, is for these friends to go ahead and take on and make Homeport into something different that benefits a lot of people and provides opportunities the way that Lola used to do.
So are you going to bring them back?
You know,
I couldn't
there is
help
a
that.
Sequel
I had
in the
to
works.
Say that.
There is a sequel in the works, and I'm actually excited about the fact that the new Homeport, the place, the way that it will be in the future, is well on its way. And so I will have all of these characters coming back, but I laughed, Fran, because there's a part of me that's trying to figure out a way to bring Lola and Dory back, if only for a cameo appearance. I just love them so much. Now, of course, the challenge is they're dead.
Well,
that's the great
thing
about writing.
You
can do whatever you want. So,
you could
so
bring
I'm going to try
back.
To reassemble the whole cast and crew. The book is tentatively called The Homeport Murders, and I've written the draft outline of it, but I've got to write the actual pages yet.
Well, you could have Lola and Dory brought back as spirits.
That's where I'm thinking maybe. I don't want to commit too much, but if there's a way I can do it that seems realistic and useful. I actually, when I finished the book, it was an emotional moment for me, and I thought, gee, I love these two ladies. Why did I kill them off? But I sort of had to.
Well, you know, you don't have to really kill them off, and like I said, you could always use them to help solve the murders.
Well, I'm going to take that under advisement, friend. That's a great thought. You'll have to wait for the book to come out, but I'm not above stealing your idea.
That's okay. Be my guest. I wrote my first murder, but it probably will not be as good as anyone else's, but we're hoping for it. I just have to have the energy to sit down and read it.
That's the great thing, you know. You write and you get better every day, so just
I
do
try.
It.
God I have my book reviews. I don't know. when creating your novel and the romance scenes between the two guys, before we end, like 10 minutes, how did you keep the scenes at a tasteful level? And why did you decide on two gay men as your main characters, which I thought they were great, by the way. So if anybody has, you know, that's just how I feel.
Well, that's a fantastic question, Fran. You know, I think it comes out of the fact, you know, from two sort of points. I'm gay myself, so of course that's my perspective and worldview. But I've also been very, very involved in the fight for marriage equality. And I participated with GLAAD, which is Gay Lesbian Advocates of Defenders up here in Massachusetts, and actually was briefed and worked with Mary Bonato, who just did that marvelous job in front of the Supreme Court last spring. So I felt a certain amount of I had an opportunity to show that, you know, a loving commitment to each other, you know, just as a man and a woman. And in the political side of things, you know, a lot of the kind of radical folks that attack marriage equality and everything, they don't do it as much as they used to, but they used to, you know, gay people are perverted, they're going to, you know, attack your children, they're very promiscuous, there's all this nonsense. So I felt a really strong moral responsibility to show a loving commitment, and the book kind of needed it to be physical. And the way I kind of thought about it was, it's somewhat like driving a car over the mountains, you know, on a very narrow road. You can fall off either side. So I was really worried if I'd fall into schmaltz and it would be too schmaltzy, or I didn't want it to be pornographic. So I wrote it and rewrote it.
It was the first time that I've read, and I read a lot, people, too much, and I've read romance novels both sides. And this is the first time that I was actually able to read the scene without saying, this is over the top, I can't stand it. And I've read several romance novels that other people have written, famous authors, and I'm going like, I'm not reading that because I don't really need to see that. And I want me to read it because it's a little too graphic. And it sort of makes the book, instead of a romance novel, it goes into the erotica category, which Fran doesn't read ever.
You know, there's a funny quick story, Fran. I got a review on Goodreads of the book, and the reviewer she actually calculated how long it was before the two lovers got into bed together, and she was terribly upset that it took 60% of the book before there was a sex scene, and that just, I laughed out loud when I read that. I could see her marking down every page, you know, no sex, no sex, no sex. It was hysterical.
I thought it was perfect because when things happen too soon, it's fake.
That's right.
And
life
things,
isn't like
when
that
things
usually
take their time and they blossom, it's real.
That's right.
So
that's exactly
that's
the way
my
I wanted
take
it to
on
be.
It. See, I usually get it. So where can everyone learn more about you and your work? And I'm going to put you on the spot. I have my own magazine. It's called MJ Magazine. It's for writers, readers, authors, and there's a speak-out section where you could speak out about whatever makes you happy. It's a memory of my sister who died, Marcia Joyce, who challenged me when I was retired from teaching in 2003. I'm a reading and writing specialist. In case anybody doesn't know, this girl has 4 master's degrees, and she's pretty smart, we think.
That's pretty
odd. My mom had Alzheimer's, and I was elected to take care of her, and that's okay. But I also weighed 190 pounds going on 200. My sister called me one day, and she said, you know, you're going to be a couch potato, or you're going to do something with your life. I said, let me know after I get mom's, well, settled. About 3 years later, she said, you know, you weigh like 200 pounds, and now I weigh 106, 107. And she said, you got to do something. Why don't you review books because you like to read and you're really smart? Well, this lady out of nowhere challenged me to review her cookbook, and Fran doesn't know what the knobs on the stove do. My husband cooks. Forget that.
Neither do I.
I have no clue what you do with the stove. So I reviewed Martha Cheeves, Stir, Laugh, and Repeat, which was probably one of the best cookbooks with little home journal of her own at the bottom of little tidbits and things about her family. And I reviewed the book, and it was hilarious. It took me forever. She said that it was probably the funniest thing that they've ever heard and ever written. It was hysterical. And then out of that came a snowball of people.
And the magazine now.
So
that's
my
great.
My reviews are different. Well, if you're looking for ordinary and synopsis, you're not going to find it. I'm going to find something different about your book and let the whole world know. So where can everybody learn about you? And I love Agatha Christie. She's my favorite person. I love her.
My website, acburch.com, acburch.com is the best place to start. And from there you can see links to Facebook and Twitter and all of that sort of stuff, and that's a good way to do that. And I'm a big Agatha Christie fan as well. I just love her. And
Me too.
Did you see that they just recently came out with a contest from the Christie Estate to name the favorite mystery?
Mm-hmm.
And they said it was, and then there were none. But I disagree. My favorite is The Murder of Roger Ackroyd. That's the one that I really love the most.
I'm seeing her right now
because I'm working on mystery plotting and everything for the sequels of the Homeport Journals.
Well, I read The Golden Age of Murder by Martin Edwards, and
mm-hmm.
that focuses on Dorothy Sayers, Agatha Christie's real story,
yeah.
and a whole bunch of people in the Detection Club.
Okay.
Probably one of the hardest books
yeah,
I've ever
right.
read, and it was fantastic. If you want to know the real scoop and the dope about Agatha Christie, you got to read it.
I'm going to. I haven't read it yet. I will. Absolutely.
Oh, it was great. They sent it to me out of nowhere, too. They just get everything out of nowhere. So, before we close, who's your favorite mystery writer?
It is really Agatha Christie.
Goody.
I thought a lot about that. I really love Walter Mosley. I don't know if you've read much of his work, but he's great.
No.
His dialogue is fantastic. He writes language like music, spoken language like music, and I've read just everything that he's written. I also like P.D. James.
I love her.
Yeah. And, you know, I kind of blush to admit this. I still love Earl Stanley Gardner and the Perry Mason stories.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're kind of out of fashion right
Mason
now, but
too.
I really love them. And I go back to them every once in a while when I just want to lose myself in a quick read. But Dame Agatha, when all is said and done, and particularly Miss Marple, she mm-hmm. really comes across to me, and I love that character of the old lady that sees. And you know, there's some analogies with the Homeport Journals. She lived in a small village. Provincetown is a small village. Everybody knows what's going on. Same thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to try to use some of that in the sequel.
Well, I love Hercule Poirot. And I love Inspector Morse.
Yes.
I do like Morse
a lot. And the actor that played him on the PBS series looks a lot like my father did. And so that's been
really
kind of interesting because my father was a school principal. He wasn't a detective, but I used to watch those shows and almost see him come back to life. It was kind of interesting.
I love him. And I don't think anybody really knew that Patricia Rutledge plays Hetty Winthrop, a detective.
Yes, I saw those.
I love that program.
I had a problem with her. She acted it very well, but I kept seeing Mrs. Bucket every time I watched her because I love
Patricia Rutledge. I think she's completely amazing. Of course, she's crazy as Hyacinth Bouquet. I love her, but I loved her in the role of Hetty Winthrop, and I wish that they never took it off. I love that show.
Did you ever see her do? There's a series of short Alan Bennett plays. And they're monologues, basically. And Patricia Rutledge does some of them, and they're really good. They're really good. If you haven't seen them, look them up. You can get them on video, and they're really fantastic.
I think she's freaking amazing. But anyway, I want to thank you so much. And, I started to say, my magazine, I would love for you to write an article for my magazine or whatever
thrilled.
You want.
I will look into that, and I'll be in touch. I'd be delighted to do that. Thank you so much for asking me.
I will, and I'm going to send you, if I can remember what I did with it, a copy of the magazine so that you can get to know the type of stuff that I do. And people say it's a very good magazine, I hope.
Excellent.
I'm going to email you. Thank you so much for talking with you.
I've had a wonderful time.
Thank you. And please make sure I get the sequel first.
Oh, you will. You will. You'll be one of the first. Trust me.
Thank you so much, and have a great day. And everybody, I'll see you Monday at 10 with Simon Chavez, and Thursday with mental health specialist that works at a mental health asylum, Dr. Kenneth Ween. It should be very interesting. And everybody, have a great day, and thank you so much. Bye.